So if you turn to the book of Revelation, chapter 2, today I'm going to be talking about the church in Thyatira. And you remember I've been going through the series of the different churches of the book of Revelation, and what is it that Jesus Christ is trying to teach us from what happens with all these seven churches. And there's so much information in just 11 verses that I decided that I'm going to split it into two sermons. So today I'm going to focus on providing some background information on the city of Thyatira. What was the pagan religious landscape of the region like? Why was Jesus rebuking the congregation? And then to see how history repeats itself as we listen to the lessons covered in this book. In my next sermonette, I'll be speaking about Jezebel. And in both messages, I'll be talking about why this knowledge matters and what is a call to action. So if we go to Revelation 2, we start in verse 18. To the angel of the church in Thyatira write, "These are the words of the Son of God, whose eyes are like blazing fire, and whose feet are like the burnished bronze. I know your deeds, your love and faith, your service and perseverance, and what you're now doing more than you did at first." And there we go again, just like in the previous churches. There's not a good thing you like to hear. Nevertheless, I have this against you. So we'll stop there for the time being. So let me share some information about Thyatira. Thyatira was founded by Alexander the Great. It started as a military garrison, went through a lot of wars and battles, and the city was destroyed a number of times. And after the death of Alexander the Great, Seleucus I Nicator, known also as Seleucus the Victor, one of Alexander's most powerful generals, became the ruler of that city, in that region. Thyatira was a very lively, commercially active center of commerce in that region. It is currently the city of Akhisar, Turkey, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Akhisar, Turkey. And the other thing about this particular city is that it was very active in terms of the guilds, the vocational guilds of the region of the city, and its religious diversity. Although it was not a large city, it played a very important role, commercial role, in that region of Turkey or Asia Minor, and it had an impact also on early Christianity. It had a presence of Christians in a particular region. Like I said, it was a commercial hub. It was located between Pergamon and Sardis, and actually Pergamon is the church that is covered previous to Thyatira, and Sardis is a church that follows in the book of Revelation that is discussed, which I'll be covering in the future. And it's also it is also said about Thyatira that it was a small city, and it was a secondary trade route in the region. But it still flourished economically due to access to a place called Lycus Valley, which was rich in agriculture. The artisan guilds. The city was very famous for its highly organized trade guilds that were very strong and very influential in terms of what happened in the city. And more than any other city in the region, this city, Thyatira, had this very strong trade guilds. They included dyers, bronze smiths, leather workers, potters, bakers, silversmiths, and others. It was also very strong in the part of textile and dyeing industry. Thyatira was especially renowned for its production of purple dye, likely derived from madder rot rather than shellfish like in other places. And of course, you know, in Acts 16:14, Lydia is mentioned. She was very close to the Apostle Paul. She was a seller of purple cloth from Thyatira. The waters of Thyatira had also strong minerals that facilitated the production of this, you know, coloring the textiles. It was also cosmopolitan culture. The city hosted a mix of Greeks, Romans, Jews, and others, creating a diverse and dynamic social fabric. Hence, the door was open for all kinds of belief systems to cater to the Thyatira's syncretic rich culture, and Christians felt the pressure of all the syncretism. From a religious landscape perspective, what was it like to be in the city? It was filled with pagan temples. Right? One of the deities was Apollo Tirismus, the sun god, which is Apollo, the Greek Apollo, but it was a syncretist version of Apollo, a Greek-Roman god. But he represented a localized, syncretized version, as I said, and it was a fusion of Apollo's identities with his regional Anatolian and possibly Hittite elements. There was also the worship of Baratheon and Sambethe throughout the city. And these cults were often intertwined with guilt activities, including feasts and rituals that conflicted with Christian ethics. From a commercial, social, and religious links, what was the link between commerce, social, and religious life? There was not such thing as a separation of church, state, and commerce, commercial interests in that particular city. And as a member of the guild, you were expected to participate in all guild-sponsored events, including religious practices and ceremonies. And the last thing the guild wanted you to do, if you were a member, okay, was to insult the gods. Because if the gods wasn't happy with the guild that was sponsoring, the god that sponsored this particular guild, okay, they would kick you out. They would kick you out of the guild. And because it was a closed shop, it was very difficult to sort of be part of this guild. So you just couldn't operate outside of the guild. You had to operate within the guild. So Christians had to walk this very delicate dance with the guilds to be able to remain inside, but at the same time not be participants of some of the pagan practices that they pretty much promoted. But I'll say more about these guys in my following message. With this background, let us understand why Jesus reveals himself as follows. Like we read in Revelation chapter 2, verses 18 and 19. Again, let's review that again. To the angel of the church in Thyatira write, "These are the words of the Son of God." This is the only time that Jesus calls himself Son of God in the book of Revelation. The reason, you know, some scholars say that this is happening is because Apollo was also worshipped as the Son of God. He was also called the Son of God. So Jesus saying is, he can't claim that. I am the true, you know, Son of God. So it was to remind Christians through this message, don't get confused in terms of who the real Son of God is. It continues, quote, "whose eyes are like the blazing fire." If you compare that to Revelation 2:28 and 22:16, let's go first to 22:16, if you don't mind, in Revelation. It says, "I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright morning star." And back in Revelation 2, verse 28, it says, "I will also give that one the morning star." So this morning star reference goes back to when Jesus described that Jesus is a blazing fire and morning star. And he was telling people it is not Venus. Venus, the goddess, was the brightest object in the sky before sunrise. And in pagan symbolism, it meant hope, renewal, and the coming of light to the pagans. But Jesus Christ is making that claim. I am the light. I am the morning star. Not that star that you see early in the morning that represents Venus. I am he. So he's talking directly and against the pagan practices and beliefs of the people of the time. And he continues, and whose feet are like burnished bronze. A reminder that Jesus as God has all power at his disposal. He owns all metals and personifies himself as the priority over the guilds. Because there was also a very powerful guild that did works with bronze. So he's reminding them, you pay attention to me, you don't pay attention to the guilds. What are the spiritual implications of these pagan beliefs and the problems that the Christians were having, that they were becoming corrupt, embracing some of these pagan practices? If you go directly to the Boeotian cult, like others in Thyatira, this religion was involved in mixing guilt feasts, idolatry rituals, and mysticism. They will put all those together, and it would challenge Christian practices because they would encourage Christians, come and join us in our practices. Let's go and honor our gods, okay? Because he's our patron god, and if you don't participate, like I said before, they can get offended, and as a result, then it can have a negative impact in their guilds, and we don't want that to happen. What was the consequence of this, and what is the message for today, and how does it show up today? How does it show up today? Today we have what is called patron saints. And notice that these guilds have particular gods that they worship in order to support the particular guild. The saints thing has happened today, and it started particularly strong. It started to flourish, even though it was there before. During the medieval times, when the trade guilds flourished again in Europe, and many adopted patron saints who embody the crest, values, or spiritual aspirations of that particular guild. We have, for instance, I remember in Puerto Rico, we call it fiestas patronales. It was patron saints, feast, where they carry the saint in their shoulders in a statue, and people would just go in this procession around town carrying this figure, and everybody was supposed to worship that particular patron saint. Okay, it still happens to this day. So we need to understand why Christ back then was telling them, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't support, these religious practices because, they go against me. They're going to distract you from truth and reality. So we have, for instance, a patron saint, Saint Eligius. He was a patron saint for the guild of metal workers and blacksmiths. Saint Honoré for bakers. St. Crispin and St. Crispian, shoemakers. St. Omobotus, tailors, and on and on. And let me mention this one, St. Nicholas of Myra, for sailors, which, by the way, is the same saint that started the tradition of St. Nicholas or Santa Claus to this day. Okay? So you can see all the consequences, what happens when you start disobeying God and following practices that God tells us not to practice. So that's why he was so concerned with this particular church in Thyatira and their practices. The other thing that happens is that when you have all these patron saints, what they're doing, they're replacing Christ in terms of being the intercessor between us and the Father, which is blasphemy, which is, again, blatant paganism. So what are the key lessons to learn here? And I'm going to repeat myself on these particular themes, because Jesus Christ repeats these themes over and over again. First, it's very important to remain faithful to canon-approved doctrine. Do not rely on sources that contradict the Bible. God has repeated in Scripture that we are not to add or subtract from his word. Second, what might appear innocent or worth exploring is repeating an old mistake that started back in the Garden of Eden, when the serpent tempted Adam and Eve. curiosity and inquiry are good, but ask God for wisdom to help you discern what is worth exploring. And third, notice how the pagan practices of ancient guilds gave license to create gods tied to vocations. It also led to the creation of the folklore figure of St. Nicholas or Santa Claus. The point is that there are serious consequences from syncretism. And that's why this church is called corrupt, why this church was practicing corruption. In other words, when he was talking to the church, he told them, "Now I say to you," in verse 24, 25, "now I say to the rest of you in Thyatira, I will not impose any other burden on you. I'm not going to ask you to do anything else. You're doing, if you're doing the right thing, except to hold on what you have until I come. Hold on to what you're doing correctly, but you need to fix this. You need to fix this problem with the syncretism." Okay, so what is the message to us? The message is very simple. Do not compromise.